Welcome to Prophecy Radio, the Percy Jackson podcast that will keep you up to date on all things Rick Riordan and Rick Riordan Presents, including upcoming books, adaptations, and more. My name is Karen.
I'm Kristen.
And this is episode number 148. Today we're talking about Percy Jackson and the Olympians, Season 2, Episode 2. We just recorded yesterday, and even though we were like, we're going to do all of these, like, over Zoom or whatever, you're here in person today because it was just more convenient to do this.
Yes, Kristen's day is packed full of goodies, as it always is on Sundays, especially in football season. And so, yeah, it just made more sense to come do this one in person. Which is yay, because the rest of them, honestly, will probably be done apart. So, for a little while, you'll be hearing a lot of our Zoom, the Zoom tones.
By the way, did you see what shirt I'm wearing
today? I did!
Yeah.
I haven't put mine on yet. I think I bought myself the Reader's Quadrant one.
Oh, okay.
Or I might have bought the Writer's Quadrant because I like that dragon the best.
Oh, okay.
Like, that's the cutest dragon because she has a whole line of Writer's Quadrant, Reader's Quadrant. Like, there's all kinds of different ones. And they all have a slightly different, I liked the font and the dragon for the Writer's Quadrant the best.
Yeah.
It's
I
just
like
cute.
It made me happy. Also, my Lion sweatshirt is dirty, so I'm doing laundry right now.
Nice.
You know.
Mine is in my bag, and if I get too cold, it may have to make an appearance because I almost froze this morning at church, but this was the only shirt that looked comfy today, so I threw it on, didn't think about it, walked outside and was like, it's negative 10 wind chill. Like, yay. Yeah, I'm freezing my butt off, so.
Yeah, it's been very cold. Although this week, I think one of the days is supposed to get up to like 49, and I'm hoping I can use that day to finally put up the outside Christmas decorations, which seems kind of pointless now that we're halfway through the month, but I'm gonna do it. I usually leave them up till like February anyway.
I was gonna say, you can leave them up through most of January. Yeah. A lot of people do, so like, that makes a big deal. Yeah.
But we have another jam-packed episode today. You know, same deal as last time. If you want to talk to us about anything we usually gab about, including Percy Jackson, please let us know, by the way, how you feel about the season so far. We are totally in love with it, but that's probably no surprise to, like, literally anybody. You can contact us at Prophecy Radio Podcast on Instagram or email us at prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. We love hearing from you. Since we recorded yesterday, we don't have any news and updates because we did them all in the last monster episode. So we're going to just move right on to the main discussion for episode two.
Yeah, because, I mean, season two, episode two.
Yeah.
Demon pigeons attack.
This was a big one.
It's a big episode.
Yeah. For a lot of different reasons, but very highly anticipated, too.
Yes, because this episode contains the long-awaited chariot race. And that is basically the beginning of this episode. Mm-hmm. So, Camp Sporter is failing, and that is, like, the entire, like, bubble border, not just the literal, like, geographical border.
Yeah.
You can kind of see all the Stymphalian birds, like, flocking at the top of
which was
the
super creepy, by the way.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And, like, Annabeth mentions that, like, yeah, they've been, they're testing and waiting for the boundary to fail so that they can come through. And the way they do when they finally do, like, come through, it's so creepy.
It is.
Like, I'm not that freaked out by birds, but that was really,
really creepy. I'm very freaked out by birds. I also did not like it, but they look so cool. Like,
they do.
The CGI for them and the opening shot of the episode being the birds coming down.
And the close-up.
Yeah. Like, when we were just kind of going through the clouds, I was like, oh my god, what's happening? Is this going to be like a Zeus thing or like what? And then it clicked that it was going to be the birds, and I was like, oh, this is an awesome way to open the episode.
Yeah, I kind of wondered if we were going to get like a Sally moment or something to start this episode, like, were they coming through the clouds to do something, you know, like, we got some of those flashbacks in season one to start episodes. I was like, maybe we're gonna, no. And then as soon as I saw, like, the birds, I was like, oh, yeah, I know exactly where they're going with this, okay, so Percy and Annabeth are going to use Percy's rule-breaking strategy, which is totally genius, why not? He's bound to break a rule or two anyway.
Yeah.
Might as well use it to your advantage, for sure.
I love that. I don't remember exactly what he said, but something about it being, like, his superpower. And I was like, that's great.
Right?
Totally. And very true.
So, Percy just being out of his cabin is breaking the rules at the moment. And so him kind of standing in the middle of the chariot stadium, of the chariot race stadium, waiting for Tantalus to come and get him, basically. As soon as Tantalus leaves Chiron's office, which I'm going to call it Chiron's office because that's definitely not Tantalus' office. As soon as he leaves Chiron's office, we see Annabeth pull off her Yankees cap and she goes to town. She's looking through all of Chiron's stuff. I think looking for a drachma because she doesn't have any and Percy doesn't have any and she was hoping there would be one in there. Mm-hmm. She also clearly is like trying to see if Chiron left anything behind that's worth noting.
Yeah.
Any sort of hint as to how to fix any of the things going wrong at the moment. First of all, I love the Easter egg of, like, Chiron's musical choices here.
Yes. So I couldn't, because I'm blind, I could not read the tape.
I couldn't either.
Oh, okay.
But I kind of recognized it. I was like, I know that tape. Like, I've seen the album art for that before. Mm-hmm. I couldn't place what it was until later on in this episode when we find out what it was.
That's okay. It's the same thing. Yeah. Gotcha.
It was, I'll just say it, it was Mariah Carey's Emotions.
Right.
Like, it was the album that came on. Mm-hmm. And it just, like, yeah, that moment, we'll get to it. But, like, that moment later is just...
It's
chef's kiss. Yeah. I love it. So, Annabeth finds a drachma and Iris messages Chiron, who it has been banned from contacting campers. But Annabeth points out, you didn't contact me, I contacted you, loophole, we're fine.
Yeah.
And Chiron kind of notes, like, that's right.
Yeah.
That's my smart girl. I knew I knew you'd get there eventually and you'd, you know, reach out. So
also, can we just please mention the party ponies?
I know.
I was so excited that, like, at least we got, like, a glimpse of them. And, like, Chiron's just in his little Hawaiian shirt and, like, he's got his sunglasses on and he's just chilling. And then he kind of goes back into, like, Chiron mode. And I was like, oh, that is so funny.
Yeah. So he tells her a whole lot of things, mm-hmm. most of which is, do not tell Percy about anything.
Yeah.
He can't go on the quest. He can't know about the great prophecy that Chiron doesn't give her, but hints at it's big, it involves Percy, and because of that, you can't let him be involved in this at all. Mm-hmm. And I did love, like, how she acted that moment with the I can't lie to him.
Yeah.
She was so pissed at Chiron for asking her to do it. It's like, I know how this is going to go over. I know he's going to feel betrayed. Like, I don't want to do this to him. Mm-hmm. But she also knows it's for his best. It's for everyone's best. It's for the greater good. It's for everybody. So,
yeah. I really liked that whole part for, like, so many different reasons. Because even though Percy came up to her at the end of the last episode and was like, sorry that I kind of, you know, didn't ditch her, but like didn't have time to talk to you, but I have a solution to our problem. She's well within her rights to be angry at him still and disappointed and hurt. And she's not using any of that as motivation to be like, yeah, I have no problem lying to him because he's kept things from me. Like, that never even crossed her mind because she was instantly like, I can't lie to him.
Yeah, I don't know if it's that they both kind of feel that the stuff that's happened this year that they haven't had a chance to really, like, talk about is, like, other.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, this is future related. Like, uh-huh. This is us getting to Grover, us saving camp. This is a different thing. Our personal stuff, we'll get there.
Yeah.
Like, we need to talk about that, but if it has to wait, it has to wait. And, like, yeah, I really love that she kind of doesn't even think twice about, uh-huh. I don't want to lie to him. I don't want to tell, you know, I don't want to have to try and keep him out of all of this stuff. Like, why? Like, why is this the, you know, my task?
But I also, one, just getting a mention of the Great Prophecy is awesome, because obviously with the movies, that was something that they, like, really messed up the timeline on.
Yeah.
But also, I think this is such an interesting way to create conflict between the two characters in a way that, like, neither one of them is gonna like this situation. Annabeth does not like what she has to do, but like you were saying, this is more important than anything, and she's gotta do it anyway. And once again, Percy's gonna kind of feel betrayed, and
yeah.
I think that just, like, I keep saying this, but it still continues to be true. The two of them go through a lot before they end up together, and it's all of these little trials and tribulations that lead to such a strong relationship.
And I have to say, watching them, and like, it's not miscommunication, it's keeping secrets for the other's benefit,
yeah,
and trying to do what's right for each other by keeping each other. It's giving me like those really great WBCW, like, dramatic shows back in the late 90s, early 2000s. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm getting, like, early Vampire Diaries vibes from this.
Yeah.
Where it's, like, that perfect angsty, like, I want to just tell you everything, but I can't, because if I do, you're gonna get yourself in all kinds of trouble,
yeah,
and the world could end, and, you know, all this other. So it's, like, it's so good. It's so, so good. There was just scene after scene after scene in this episode between Leah and Walker, Percy and Annabeth, that is just like, you could just eat the tension with a spoon, and it's so good. It's so well earned, too. Like, it feels organic,
yeah,
to the story. That was like a Darren Criss, just like his voice in my head was like, say organic, because he uses it all the time.
Oh.
Anyway, so yeah, she talks to Chiron, is, you know, is told, keep it a secret. That's basically the end of that scene, and we flip back to the chariot coliseum. What do they even call that? To the chariot race
the
area.
Stadium?
Stadium?
Think, yeah, yeah. There's a specific name for that, like, track.
Right, yes.
And I forget what it, because I've been to one in Greece.
Ooh.
And that was, like, really cool.
That is really cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, so we flip back to the chariot track, and Clarice is flirting? Question mark? She's definitely kind of aggressive about it.
I don't know if I've talked about this on here before, but, like, I have very terrible secondhand embarrassment. I cannot, like, Kevin Love and his brother and a lot of his cousins and friends like watching cringe shows. I can't do it. Like, it makes me so incredibly uncomfortable. By the way, it's called a hippodrome.
Hippodrome, yes. Okay.
But I covered my eyes during this part because I was like, Clarice, oh my God, you are being so aggressive.
Yeah.
And like you could tell she was sort of like, you know, I'm hot stuff, and like, you know, she's just being her. And then he's like very honest with her, like, can you please step back? And like, you could tell, like, her feelings are really hurt.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And, like, she's a little embarrassed because you can tell, like, she thought she was nailing it. Like,
yeah,
she thought, like, this is flirting, like, 101. I'm knocking this out of the park. And it's like, I'm afraid of you.
Yeah.
Please back away. Yeah. So you could tell she is a little embarrassed, a little hurt, and just kind of is like, okay.
And I also liked that, like, Percy was laughing because, of course, he's going to laugh. But, like, he wasn't being a jerk about it. He was just literally standing there witnessing it.
Like, that was awkward.
She gets, like, super defensive.
Oh, yeah.
Which, again, I understand why.
She just, like, looks at him and is like, aren't you supposed to be in your cabin? Like, what are you even doing here? Yeah. Yeah. Good stuff. How do we feel about the new Chris Rodriguez?
I mean, I definitely don't have any issues with it. I think that it's fine. I'm very interested to see more of him because we didn't really get a whole lot.
Well, and I think I remember hearing that, like, the actor that played Chris Rodriguez in the first season wasn't, like, cut from the show.
Yeah, I
thought he's still going to be, like, around. He's just going to be a different character.
Yeah.
They just recast the actual character, which I thought was cool because, like, he didn't do a bad job. It's just I think they wanted to go a different direction since this character has a lot of interaction with Clarice.
Yeah.
My guess is they wanted someone that was kind of a little more, like, at her level.
Well, and I thought, I mean, stop me if I'm wrong, but I thought the original Chris actor, like, got into trouble or
was
something
that
like
one?
That. I thought it was.
You know, someone did, like, an article, and they had the old Chris actor, and they may have had the wrong actor in the article.
Oh. Because
I might be thinking about the wrong actor.
Oh, okay.
There was one that had, like, really floppy hair that was always kind of around Luke and Clarice.
Yeah.
And then there was one that was, like, kind of had a hairstyle closer to the one we have now. And I think he's the one that got in trouble.
Oh.
I'm not sure. Because, like, there was a different guy with Clarice in the bathroom than there was with, like, Luke at the dais.
Yeah.
And, like, they kind of crossed over. Those characters kind of, like, moved in between, and I'm not sure which one is the one.
Okay. We'll have to look into
that. Yeah, we'll keep
an eye on it. I'm curious.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You are right. There was one that got in some kind of trouble.
Yeah.
I don't remember which one it was, but yeah. I think this guy is going to be great. He's really, like, pretty.
He's really, really, like,
delicate. His features are a little softer than I would have, like...
Really? I thought they were, like, the opposite. Like, his head and his jaw are, like, very square.
You are right there. Yeah. I don't know if there's just something about his face that I was just like, he's got, like, a really pretty face.
He looks, like, kind. And I like that so far. He's sort of, like, he's not posturing or anything. He's just sort of, like... himself, like, yeah. He doesn't feel like he's, like, you know, I feel like a lot of people wouldn't tell Clarice to her face, like, can you please, like, step back?
Yeah,
like, he's not afraid of her, but he's not posturing. So I thought that was a really interesting combination,
and I think a smart one to start here, because, like, we know that Clarice and Chris kind of get close, so it's like he's not pushing her away, but he's like, that's a little intense.
Yeah,
but yeah, just take a step back and we'll try again.
Yeah.
It'll be fine. Yeah. Like, I like how they're handling it so far. We'll see how it goes in the future. I will say that this episode, even more than the first one, which pretty honestly did a pretty good job of it too, feels like classic, like, book Clarice. Mm. First season did too, but we didn't get that much of her. It was kind of limited at the beginning. But this just feels like the character bounced off the page, which... in previous incarnations of this character, did not feel the same. Whereas I feel like this is a really honest, like, true to book, you know, that character is exactly what I'm seeing on screen.
Yeah. I think that it would be very easy to make Clarice one-dimensional. You can say that about the book character, too, in the beginning. Very easy to make her one-dimensional because she is the bully. Mm-hmm. And that is her, like, main role. And then as the series goes on, she grows into a more three-dimensional person. As you learn more about her relationship with Aries, as you see her grow closer to Chris, Selena, like, all of them... And I think that it was so important for them to show her being kind of awkward and embarrassing because that makes her a real person. She's not just the bully who always has the comeback, who's always kind of intimidating Percy. He gets to see a different side of her, and that makes her way more human. And oh, I really love that they decided to throw this little moment in there.
Right? Just enough to round her out so she's not just the leader of the little army that's running around protecting camp and the bully and, you know... She is more layered than that, and yeah, we're getting just a glimpse at it at the moment. Okay, so then we bounce back to Annabeth in Chiron's office, and she is talking to him and tells him the exact coordinates that Grover gave Percy for the Golden Fleece. And in a second, we're gonna see Percy tell Tantalus the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Why does neither of them feel that this is, like, privileged information?
Mm.
Like, I know... with Chiron, I can kind of see, like... Annabeth knows him and knows him so well. She can trust him. Can she trust that no one else can hear this message? I don't know. Obviously, she's not worried about it because she says it pretty readily. Percy to Tantalus completely confuses me. Like, I don't know if he thought he could earn goodwill by telling him.
I think it was like I'm proving to you I know exactly where we need to go. Just send me there.
Yeah. Because it just feels like they are just throwing coordinates all around. Yeah. Like, I know where to go. This is what we need. Send me. And it's like, by telling them what they need to know, they can send anyone. Mm-hmm. And it might just be their youth coming to the, you know, coming to the forefront. That they're not really thinking through, if I tell them everything they need to know, they won't need me for the quest. So maybe it's just, a little bit their youth kind of coming through. This is where, Chiron warns Annabeth about the Great Prophecy, and she is really, really not happy. But he did also mention that Annabeth absolutely needs to be on the quest for the Golden Fleece, which by the end of this episode, there's a little wrinkle in that, so I'm a little curious, like... you know, how that's gonna wind its way. I mean, we know, but we'll kind of see how it's gonna wind its way back and get that fixed by the end. I did love the line, he can't know there's something he can't know.
I kind of hated it. I thought it was a little clunky, and I feel like they could have worded it better, but I liked the idea of what they were trying to say.
Like, I liked the idea of, like, illustrating that, like, he's not even, he can't even be aware that there's something he's not allowed to be aware of. And she doesn't necessarily do a great job of hiding that by the end of this episode, but it's, she tries. She tries really hard. Also worth noting, like, Chiron is aware that Kronos is, like, setting a trap for Percy, and it is, that is why he can't know about any of this, because Percy will fall into the trap trying to stop Kronos, and he knows it, so. We go back to the chariot scene, and all I wrote in my notes was Boon, LOL. It's such a small moment, but I love how Percy not understanding what Boon means, Annabeth defining it for him and giving him an example of it, like, it's the perfect illustration of how they work. Percy doesn't know what it means, but he's just going to go with it. Annabeth says, you need to know what it means because it's the solution to our problem, tells him, he learns, and is like, oh, yeah, okay. It just, like, it perfectly, she imparted knowledge to him without embarrassing him about it. He didn't have to, like, worry about admitting he didn't know something, and she just, you know, gave him what he needed to know, and away they went. And I just, it was a perfect little, like, moment for the two of them.
Yeah. I loved all of this for those reasons, but also it was very funny. Like, every time he touched the chariot, it would just keep falling apart, which was great. I also really liked that Annabeth figured out a way to convince Percy not to be on the same team as her, to, like, double their odds of winning without making it obvious. Like, she's being sneaky, and, like, obviously we don't want her to be sneaky, but we also empathize with why she has to be sneaky. And I thought this was, like, she finds very clever ways to, like, manipulate him, and I think that really shows the fact that she's a daughter of Athena. Like, they displayed that, they depicted that very well throughout this whole episode.
Definitely. So then we bounce back to the cabins, and Percy is talking to Tyson, and Tyson mentions that he wrote Sally, and I just loved that Tyson had the forethought. Like, it's his kindness coming forward. Like, Sally was supposed to drive them to camp that night. She kept saying, like, it's, you know, that's probably the better plan. And they had to go without her. Like, they had to go early. So I love that he thought to, like, let her know that they were safe. And it's, you know, Percy's like, oh.
Yeah. To be fair to Percy, he's got a lot on his mind right now. Like, he's already in cabin arrest. They are trying to protect camp. He's been having these prophetic dreams. Annabeth's been having the prophetic dreams. But also, they did kind of just, like, disappear off the street and went straight to camp. So, like, if they hadn't come home, like, if Tyson hadn't said anything and they didn't come home, like, she would have thought the worst, literally.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, it's really good that Tyson did that.
It's very smart and very kind on his part, and it, again, it just, since we're just getting to know Tyson, it's one of those little things that you remember about him, like, oh, yeah, you know, it illustrates that kindness and that kind side of him very well. We kind of talked about this with the last episode and the introduction of Tyson, but I love how they are setting up his character to be, like, very well-rounded. Mm-hmm. Like, he's not a caricature of, you know, he's not the big dumb oaf that's, you know, a little, he almost feels slow because he's not the age we think he is, like, visually. Like, we're seeing what he excels at. We're seeing him tinkering and having those skills.
That is such a good distinction because he's innocent, but he's not stupid.
Right.
And I think with him tinkering with all these little things and fixing the chariot for Percy, like, that shows you that he's not, like, useless. He's not just there as, like, a hindrance to Percy. He has his own set of skills.
Yeah, and we see him and Percy bonding, even as Percy is feeling a little resistant, especially now finding out that it's his brother. Like, that adds a whole new layer to the dynamic, and, like, you can see Percy being like, I still care about Tyson, but, like, now there's an added layer of complication, and he's pulling back just a teensy bit as he tries to wrap his mind around what this all means for him. And then we also get the mimicry, the voices, as he's telling Percy what he's hearing and things like that. it's creepy, but again, it's one of those Tyson qualities we haven't really seen come across on film, and it's honest. Like, it's exactly what Tyson would do. Like, he has that ability, and so he's not just going to give you what they said, what he heard. He's going to give it to you in their voice so that you get the full idea of what happened.
Right.
And it's a little unnerving for me, but also, like, a really cool thing, and I'm curious how they may use it as the season goes on.
Yeah, I think that'll be really, really interesting. I loved seeing them kind of bond, because you could tell that Percy's feelings were hurt a little bit, that Annabeth didn't want to be on a team with him.
Yeah.
And, like, he understands why she's saying that, and, like, ultimately agrees, but he's still very hesitant about Tyson, and he doesn't really have anybody else other than Annabeth at camp, especially now that Luke's gone.
And Grover.
And Grover. And so the fact that Tyson just, like, boom, 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 fixes the chariot wheel, and he was like, wow, that's really cool. And then kind of, like, I think after their conversation the night before, too, he has a lot more empathy for what Tyson's been through.
Definitely.
And you can see him being like, you know what? This might not be a bad idea. Why don't you join me?
Right. Like, let's do this. Yeah. We can totally do this. Okay, so that sends us back to the Hippodrome. We looked it up. It's a Hippodrome. Sends us back to the Hippodrome for the actual chariot race. So we get a whole bit with Tantalus and Mr. D kind of on a dais watching everybody get ready for the race. And I have to say, the interplay between those two, between Timothy Simons and Jason Mantzoukas, it's chef's kiss.
Yeah.
I never thought that much about Tantalus, but I love what they're doing with him on the show.
Yeah, so this is about the point in the episode where I completely changed my tune about him, because in the first episode, I feel like he was kind of whatever. Like, one-dimensional isn't quite the right word, but, like, obviously you're not meant to like him, and he doesn't have a whole lot to do in episode one. Like, there is a little bit, but he kind of, like, you know, confronts Percy and then brings him to Mr. D, and then that's sort of about it. In this one, he plays a much bigger role, and you can see, like, I finally got to see the, like, okay, we're not meant to like him, but he is kind of funny. And yeah, the interplay between the two of them, especially because Mr. D does not care about Tantalus. Like him eating the popcorn in the last episode was hilarious. And
honestly, I think having someone cursed more than he is, like, he can't have wine.
Yeah.
But, like, he can still enjoy so many other things. Tantalus can't have anything. So, like, I think having that to lord over him and to eat in front of him is, like, giving Mr. D life this season.
Yeah. Yeah, I really like it. And the little, like, moment where Tantalus, you can see, like, did he say, like, maiming is encouraged or something?
Tantalus left out the killing.
Yeah,
the
but
no
before
killing.
That.
Okay.
Because he says, like, I don't know. He basically says, like, you know, maiming's encouraged or something like that. And then, yeah, Mr. D goes, he left about the part about no killing. And he was like, that's discouraged. But things happen. And, like, that little bit is just very funny. And, yeah, I mean, I think that these two, and I think they said in the podcast, like, they're actually friends in real life, too. So, like, and they probably work very in similar types of shows. So,
yeah.
I feel like, yeah, they can play off each other really well. Also, shout out to, like, the satyr, like, henchman. He's not a henchman. He's, like, a spy.
Yes.
Goon. But he's also very funny.
Agreed.
And just the way he moves, and you can tell he's, like, very nervous. He's the one who's gonna, like, tattle on everybody.
Yeah. I think it's during the podcast after the show, they kind of talk a little bit about how Tantalus is, like, playing up to Mr. D. He knows he's not his equal, but he's trying to, like, play that he is. And I honestly love that about, like, you can see it in this scene especially. Like, he's acting like he's one of the boys, like he's, you know. And you can also see that Mr. D is just like, I finally have someone I'm smarter than. I'm better than him. I'm a god. It's, you know, Chiron was, even though, you know, not necessarily a god, was so equal to Mr. D in and greater than him in, you know, smarts and all of that. Like, Kyren kind of, you could tell, like, lorded over Mr. D a little bit how much he was actually the one in charge, mm-hmm. even though he wasn't. You can see Mr. D, like, loves that Tantalus is his inferior. And yeah. so, yeah, that play is really fun.
It's such an interesting dynamic because Tantalus, to all of the kids, the campers, is like, I'm the number one guy here. When in reality, yeah, it is Mr. D. But then Mr. D, because he doesn't care, he has somebody that he can just, like, tell him what to do. And he couldn't do that to Kyren.
Absolutely.
Because Kyren, one, probably wouldn't listen to him anyway. But, like, Kyren was invested in the kids and all of that. And, like, Tantalus just wants to, yeah, like, he's obsessed with punishing them and,
oh, yeah.
and all that kind of stuff. And Mr. D is like, this is hilarious. Just do your thing.
Right? Like, I'm having a great time.
Yeah.
Please entertain me some more.
Yeah. yeah
pretty much. Okay, so now we are getting ready for the actual race itself, and everybody's lining up, and we get a moment between Annabeth and Bondi, which I'm assuming is another daughter of Athena. Mm.
She looked so fierce.
She did.
I really
she
loved her.
She looked super fierce. I am wondering if the reason they named her, not just because she was in the chariot with Annabeth, maybe that down the line we may get some more moments with the other children of Athena. Like, we may get some other... Annabeth Bondi moments. But I really liked her, and I hope she shows up again.
Yeah. Also, shout out to all the different cabin armor outfits.
Yes.
They all looked so cool.
Like, very similar, but just different enough.
Yeah.
You can see that they each did something
like
a little
different. Like, the Hephaestus one had all the gears and stuff on it, and, like, Athena's looked like a visor for a helmet. Like, it was all really cool.
Yeah, yeah. I think... It's funny because I don't know if I really noticed it the first time I saw it, like how different everything was. The second time, when Percy came out with the blue shirt underneath, it's like my brain realized that he wasn't in the Camp Half-Blood mm. shirt, and I made me pay better attention to everyone. So then I started looking at all the different armor, and I was like, okay, they did such a good job. Like, they really knocked the costuming out of the park. For this episode. But yes, so Annabeth and Bondi have a moment where Annabeth lets Bondi know that if Percy and Tyson are taking the lead, that she is to take Percy out. Like, they cannot win this race. And Bondi kind of says, like, I thought you were tight with Percy, and Annabeth's like, I know, that's why I'm asking you to do it. Makes total sense.
Yeah.
Is very logical, but... also a little sneaky, just like, you know, we just talked about she has to be at this point. So then the race begins, and the actual, like, physical shooting of this was really well done and really cool. It looked very intense.
Yeah.
And, you know, Clarice is, of course, up to all of her normal tricks and kind of sabotaging the Hephaestus chariot before they can even get off the starting line, mm-hmm. and that causes all kinds of havoc. And then, you know, she's up to all kinds of tricks with the little pokey things on the spokes
yeah.
on her wheel. Like, she's running into people and all that kind of thing. But the race itself is just kind of intense.
Yeah. And, yeah, I think, you know, we'll probably talk about it more during the podcast part because they talk about how intense making this scene was. I gotta say, I cried. Like, like, it was one of those moments, I don't know why this is the first one that comes to my mind, but, like, the first time I saw Wonder Woman and that, like, her crossing the no man's land and, like, it's just such an intense moment that, like, lands so well. And, like, we've been wanting, just like Capture the Flag, we've been wanting the chariot race mm-hmm. on screen for so long. And it was so well done that I just immediately started tearing up. Like, it was just incredible. I think they did. I literally don't know how they could have done it better because it was fantastic.
I 100% agree. Everything in that scene, from the way they built the stands and just the set dressing and all the costumes and the chariots and the horses, and it's all really perfect. And the scene is intense and it works, and I can't imagine how hard it was to actually put all those pieces together and make it work the way it did. Such a cool scene. Clarice takes out the Hephaestus cabin. Tyson kind of accidentally eliminates the Hermes cabin. They attack him and he's able to kind of knock him out. And that is when, just after that, is when the Stymphalian birds arrive.
Mm-hmm.
And It's kind of just them all flocking at once and attacking everyone that's in the hippodrome. Mr. D swatting them like they are flies at a picnic. Like, he's barely annoyed, but he's just like, get out of my way. You know, whatever. Whereas Tantalus is screaming bloody murder.
That was so funny.
So funny.
I did not expect that at all, and it landed.
And that is what prompts Annabeth to run to Chiron's office and get the cassette tape that she just saw and his boombox, and come back and use that to use that against the Stymphalian birds. She mentions that I believe it's Hercules that uses high pitched noises against them in the Greek story. Mm-hmm. So she knew that, like, Tantalus just kind of reminded her of the story, and so she knew this would work. And it does. It repels them back up into the sky, and they disappear, and the force field kind of puts itself back together.
Mm-hmm. There were so many parts of this that I loved so much. Obviously, Tantalus screaming bloody murder was hilarious. I think Leah, and I gotta say, the editing team as well, do such a good job of showing her putting the puzzle pieces together. And, like, that's not always easy to show on screen. But the way she tilts her head and the way she looks from one place to another and then how the editing team puts all of that together, you know what she's figuring out. And that was absolutely perfect. I think Percy holding up the boombox like that was great. I think that's, like, such an iconic shot for this show, which obviously references, like, other, you know, pop culture things. But, like,
say anything.
I think that, like, I don't know. As soon as I saw, because I think that was the one of the background pictures for, like, when you go on Disney to watch the show. Like, gotcha. He's just standing there with the boombox. And I was like, this is just so perfect. It just feels like such a teenager-y show kind of thing to do. And, you know, I'm not the biggest fan of Mariah Carey, but I think that was absolutely the perfect song choice. Clearly, you know,
for her whistle tones.
Yeah. I mean, I guess you could have gotten, like, Ariana Grande if you wanted to do, like, a more modern one, but, like, Mariah Carey is classic, so.
It works because it's classic. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, I think it works better because it's Chiron's music, so it is about a decade older than the kids would normally, like, choose.
Yeah.
Yeah. It works even better, I think.
And music is such a big part of Rick's books, and, like, he's always referencing them. There's a lot of references to, like, Taylor Swift, for example, and, like, you know, if you read the Apollo series, like, that's all basically musical references. So this also felt so in line with, like, what we've seen in the books before anyway. So it was just, like, a perfect moment.
And again, not to, like, talk about all the podcast at moments, but they actually mentioned that the writer's room came up with Mariah Carey.
Yeah.
And Rick is in that writer's room. So it just feels kismet that, like, he's involved in all of those choices. And, like, again, music has been a part of this series for so long with all the references and things that, it feels absolutely perfect that it all came together like that. Okay, so after the Stymphalian birds are dealt with, everyone gathers in the big house in, like, one room, basically, to basically hear what's gonna go next. Are they gonna rerun the chariot race? Like, what's going on? And Mr. D and Tantalus are kind of running the show, as you would imagine. Mr. D's shirt in this scene looks like a tapestry, and it just kept distracting me.
I was trying to figure out what was on it, and I couldn't quite see it, but I'm curious what all was on that.
Yeah, like, I don't know if it was depicting any specific, like, you know, Greek myth or whatever, but it just looked so cool, and it did. It kind of gave me tapestry vibes, and I thought that was kind of cool. I may have to rewatch and pay close attention and, like, see if I can and make out some of it, because it just looked really interesting.
So I just opened my phone to, like, look for, see if I could just see the picture real quick.
Mm-hmm.
And you know how, like, it gives you like, Google gives you news items and stuff like that? Well, first I saw this picture of Danny DeVito in black and white, and I was like, oh my god, did he die? He did not die.
Thank goodness.
Aryan Simhadri wants Danny DeVito as Pan in upcoming season of Percy Jackson. How
please
freaking perfect.
Can we please?
I would love that. It would be perfect.
He's already played a satyr.
Oh my god.
He was Phil. He's done it in animation, so it would just... Oh, please, Disney. Please so much.
It would be... And I really like Danny DeVito.
He's so funny.
And very talented. I think he would do a fantastic job.
Yeah. Another aside, I saw this randomly. I don't know how true it is. Someone talked to Walker, and Walker wants Logan Lerman to play Triton later on in the series.
Okay.
And, like, they did, like, a drawing, like, a sketch of what Triton would look like, and had, like, a picture of Logan Lerman next to it, and I was like, that actually kind of works. And I do think, especially people like Logan who loved the character so much, it would be cool to, like, see him find a small way to be involved without, like,
yeah, taking this attention. And he's definitely said, like, he's open to the idea.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. It's just fun. But yes, Danny DeVito would be absolutely perfect for Pan. I am just going to keep my fingers crossed.
I'm kind of obsessed with it now.
Okay, so Tantalus kind of presents this information in the weirdest way possible, but he admits that the barrier will not fail for the next week. Like, he makes it sound like it's better than it is, but then he admits that they've basically got a week before the barrier's going to fail, and then they're all going to have to run screaming for their lives, I'm pretty sure is what he says, which is just so great. Thanks so much, Tantalus. And then he proceeds to kind of say, don't worry, we have a solution. He shares the coordinates in this meeting with this group of demigods, but he shares the wrong coordinates. And I'm not sure if that was on purpose or not.
I think he's just an idiot.
I think so too.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't figure out why you would purposely give this room the wrong coordinates. Like, in my head, I feel like Percy and Annabeth maybe should have told Tantalus the wrong ones, and then if someone else won the quest, like Clarice, tell Clarice the correct ones and say, listen, we didn't give him the real ones because we weren't sure we could trust him. Here, you know, we trust you to actually get this quest done. But, like, I can't see Tantalus actually thinking that hard about it.
Yeah.
So, I agree with you. I do think he's just an idiot.
By the way, I did find Mr. D's shirt. And I still can't see it, like, super up close, but from what I can tell, there's, like, a tiger with wings across his chest. And
yes.
Then basically just, like, a bunch of flowery patterns and stuff. So I don't know if it's, like, anything specific. It doesn't look, like, Greek, per se.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Just given the vibes. Just one of his shirts. One of the many...
I mean, it fits him so well, so...
One of the many crazy, like, Hawaiian, weird, strangely patterned shirts that he wears. So, at this point, Tantalus announces that because she continued on and finished the chariot race, Clarice has won the favor of... Like, she has won the boon that we talked about earlier. So she gets to ask a favor of the gods, and she is going to go on a quest. And she is going to go get the Golden Fleece to save camp. And I couldn't help but notice that in this moment that Clarice gets this information, not only is she a little surprised, which is natural, she at first doesn't seem excited. Like, her first thought isn't, yes, I get to go on a quest, like it was with Annabeth last year, where the minute Percy, like, got to camp, she's just putting together all the pieces and saying, I can't wait, this is almost quest time, like, we're getting there. She looked a little bit hesitant, and I just wonder if this isn't the first sign of her relationship with Ares giving her reasons to, like, doubt herself or reasons to pull back and not be excited about it because she knows what her dad's going to ask of her. She knows he's going to expect greatness. And what if it goes wrong? Like, I couldn't help but wonder if all those things weren't running through her head in that moment.
I would imagine that's at least part of it. I think the other part is, while I don't think Clarice is dumb or anything like that, I do think that she's more impulsive than anything, and she does rely on, like, her strength more than, for example, Annabeth, who relies on strategy and all of that kind of stuff. And so her suddenly being thrust into a leadership position might be kind of new for her, especially something as important as this, because even though she is sort of the leader of her little army, like, she was still deferring to Tantalus. You know, he is, like, she's kind of, up until this point, I feel like she's been a soldier.
She's the perfect first lieutenant. Yeah. Who takes the order and makes sure it happens.
Exactly. Yeah. And now she's the one in charge. And I think for a second, she's like, I can't mess this up.
Yeah.
And is a little bit nervous about it. And I like that they showed that. Like, she wasn't gung-ho about doing this. She was like, oh, crap. Like, this is a lot of responsibility.
And, like, Annabeth's dream was to quest, to get out of camp, to go do things, great things, and show, you know... That's never been Clarice's, like, M.O. Like, from what we know, she just wants to prove that she's the best at everything. But that doesn't necessarily mean she thinks questing is the way to do it or any of that. So, yeah, I loved this moment for her because it does. Again, it's just another moment where you fully round out that she is a complete character full of all kinds of insecurities and all the things that make them really three-dimensional. And we're seeing that already in episode 2 of season 2. So that's just fantastic. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I absolutely love about Clarice taking this on is she does not need any real convincing to take Annabeth on this quest. Annabeth stands up and says, you're going to need someone with experience, and I'm your girl, and we've got this. Like, yeah. And, like, as much as we know Clarice is not fond of Percy, Clarice, you can tell, immediately respects Annabeth's skills and says, absolutely, we've got this, I need you.
Yeah.
And so she immediately says, Annabeth will be going with me on this quest.
I love that Clarice is like, I want to win, and if it means working with Annabeth, then I'll work with Annabeth. Like,
yeah.
I feel like she can be kind of petty sometimes, but again, she's not dumb. She knows Annabeth is a fantastic choice.
Yeah. And she also hears Percy out when he stands up and says, this is, you're going to be spending a lot of time on the water, and I'm going to come in very handy. Like, pick me. And she is about to, but obviously Annabeth steers her another direction, which you can watch Percy's whole world just kind of melt around him. Like, okay, Annabeth just stopped her from taking me on this quest. Like, why would she possibly not want me around? What is going on?
Yeah.
It definitely, you can tell that he can see, the wheels are turning in his head. He knows something's going on. It's not that Annabeth doesn't want him around. Mm-hmm. It's something else is going on, and he starts to kind of put some pieces together here.
You can tell Annabeth also doesn't really want to do it, but, like, she has to. Like, this has to happen.
So Clarice instead asks Chris Rodriguez, her crush, which I'm excited to see the two of them on.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, I'm excited to see their dynamic, especially with Annabeth not really being a part of it. We'll see that in a minute. See the two of them, like, really bonding through this. So that'll be fun. But yes, it's the ultimate betrayal, but I love it. As I said before, like, I love the angst of those two going through all of this right now. It is going to make their bond and their relationship, like, that much stronger, Annabeth and Percy. Like, it's just, it's such a good, it's good tension, and I love it. I love it. That takes us to Percy's dream. I believe this is the second dream, right? The first one was in the last episode. This is the second dream.
With Grover specifically.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, yeah. Yes, yes. And this time, Grover comes to Percy.
Actually, no, it's the third one. Because the first one was him seeing Grover.
Yes.
The second one was the empathy link, and then this is another empathy link.
This is basically the second empathy link. Yeah. This time Grover kind of comes to Percy. Like, last time it almost felt like Percy came to Grover in the cave. This time Grover is showing in the cabin, but the cabin is in the middle of the ocean, which, again, I love that illustration of the empathy link, like, they're meeting halfway.
Yeah.
It's, the cabin isn't where it's supposed to be, but Grover found Percy, and Percy's pushing his part of the dream together, too.
And, like, that's so perfect for dreams, because dream logic is, like, your brain mashes up these random things together. Like, I've probably talked about this. Like, I have the wildest dreams, and sometimes the different elements from, like, that day or, like, whatever I've been thinking about coming together in one place, it's like, this makes literally no sense, but okay, dream logic. And I feel like the cabin being in the middle of the ocean is, like, the perfect...
It is.
Yeah.
It's the perfect middle ground. And yeah. It's... Yeah. I love it. I love it so much. We get to see the wedding dress.
Oh, man.
It is perfect.
I loved it.
It's so weird that we see it on Walker first.
Yeah.
We don't see it on Grover first. Walker is wearing it first, and he's like, why am I wearing a wedding dress?
Yeah.
This whole interplay between the two of them.
Perfect.
It's absolutely amazing. I can just feel their friendship. Like, yes. I can feel it viscerally in the room with us. Because it's just so well illustrated. And
it didn't feel like acting.
No.
Like, because these two kids, like, they've gotten close, and I think they get along very well. And same thing with, like, Annabeth, with Leah and Walker. Like, you can feel the chemistry between them because they're actually friends. And, yeah, I mean, I think that the wedding dress, it wasn't how I pictured it from the books, but, like, it's just, like, it's... maybe even better. I don't know. But, like, the fact that it's kind of vintage-y looking, a little, like, you know, it's not, like, fully white. It looks like it's dingy, like it's been laying in a crate somewhere for a while. Was so perfect. You're right. The fact that we see it on Walker first, and Grover was like, we don't have time to talk about it. And
Percy's like, I got it.
And Percy's like, I can't let this go. Like, come on, man, really?
Because Grover's like, don't ask. He goes, I've got
it. Yeah, and it was so perfect.
So good. And then I love that Grover leads Percy down the path of understanding. Like, Grover can see that Annabeth is clearly doing something because she knows telling him everything and letting him go on this quest is just going to cause trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So he kind of says, like, maybe she had a reason. And Percy starts to, again, is putting pieces together. And I just love that Grover leads Percy to the truth and then just kind of lets him
and doesn't
take it from
like
there.
Immediately, because I feel like sometimes when you're with your friends and they're like complaining about, you know, another mutual friend, you're like, yeah, that really sucks that they did that. Like, you kind of instantly feel empathy for the person you're talking directly to. And Grover immediately says something along the lines of, like, I don't know the whole story. But, like, he knows Annabeth well enough to know she wouldn't do this out of spite or hatred or anger or anything.
She has a reason. And you know she thinks everything through. So, like, play it out, Percy. Like, why is this happening?
Yeah.
Also, the goat-scented perfume. Again, that whole scene, the writing is absolutely fantastic so far.
Yeah. I found they've been doing such a good job giving us exposition to explain what's going on in a, like, dynamic way where it's, like, even if it is a little bit of info dumping, you're still, the scene's still moving, something's still happening, there's jokes playing out, and, like, it doesn't feel like they're just throwing all this information at you. It's actually, like, a part of something. It keeps the story flowing, and that is the sign of fantastic writing.
Oh, definitely, yeah. So far, season two, the writing has just been... They upped it a level, and I didn't... You know, first season was great, so I'm just, very excited to see how we continue to evolve on that front. So Percy sneaks out. He tells Tyson he's going to, which I think is important, and I'm glad he didn't just disappear because Tyson has enough issues with abandonment and all of that. So I was glad he kind of explained to him what he was doing and why he had to go. But he sneaks out, sneaks down to the beach. His goal is to talk to Poseidon. And even if he can't get his blessing or his help, he just wants Poseidon to know why he's doing it and to basically get approval for it.
Mm-hmm.
Not permission, but like, I want you to understand why I'm doing what I'm about to do. And I loved the line that they wrote for Percy here. I'm not asking for your help. I'm not asking for permission. I just need to know that you won't stop me.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's one of those, like, perfect scenarios where, yeah, that's exactly what he needs.
Mm-hmm.
Again, he knows Poseidon isn't the god that's going to show up and micromanage things. He's kind of hands-off. And as much as Percy hates that, like, he can't change it.
I think it's so interesting, too, because the last, like, few moments, including season one, where Percy's talked about his father have been generally, like, positive. Like, even when he talked to Tyson, he was basically like, you know, don't expect Poseidon to come down here and, like, say hi because he's busy. And I feel like throughout the series, Percy feels pretty angry toward his father. Or at the very least, like, very conflicted, because he does feel abandoned by his father. And when, you know, like this upcoming scene with Hermes, when given the opportunity to maybe pop in and, like, do something, he can't always do it. And I think that Percy understands on a logical level why that is, but it still hurts his feelings. And I've just been very curious if we're going to see more of Percy's anger, because, like I said, the last few scenes, I feel like he's kind of been giving, like, excuses, valid excuses, but excuses for his dad's, like, behavior and lack of involvement. And I kind of want to see angry Percy.
I think he's, because Tyson is also affected by Poseidon's absence, Percy's trying to smooth it. Like, he's trying to show Tyson, like, it's not you. You are not the reason Poseidon isn't coming around. Like, he doesn't come around for me either. He shows up when I most need him, aka when Zeus is about to strike me dead. He'll show up and stop him. But, like, other than that, he's not showing up for birthday parties and whatever. Like, it's not you. And so he's been very cognizant of that. I am curious if, we'll see more of Percy's just pure anger at his dad for being absent. So someone comes walking down the beach, and you can tell Percy is hoping beyond hope that it's Poseidon, but it's not. It is Hermes. And Hermes basically arrives to say, quest approved, your dad's cool with what you're about to do. Like, he's not the god of excessive verbosity, which, coming from Lynn, who is perhaps the most verbose person in the world, just is extra special.
That was very funny. I really gotta say, like, I was not neutral on Lynn's casting. He just wasn't entirely who I thought of as Hermes, but I am more and more coming around to him. I feel like he's got that, like, quick talking, like, kind of the physicality of Hermes, where he's just kind of like a little bit of a schmoozer, and I don't know, it's really working for me.
He's also got that, like, quality that's like you can't quite trust everything he's saying all the time, which is very, it's a good thing to have when you're playing Hermes, because Hermes cannot be fully trusted all the time, and Percy points that out and is like, aren't you also a trickster god? Am I supposed to just believe everything you tell me all the time? Like, I don't think so.
Yeah.
So he really is great casting, and I loved this scene with him, too.
Yeah,
absolutely fantastic.
Definitely.
The jokes, by the way. The harps and lyres and all the wordplay.
The joke about what happens in Vegas is probably why half the kids... I don't know, did he say half the kids in Hermes' cabin exists or half the kids at camp exist?
No, I think he said Hermes, because Percy says what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, and Hermes says what happens in Vegas is the reason why half of Hermes' cabin exists.
Which, like, again, just like the last episode, Disney allowing some of those, you know, like, jokes
little,
in there.
Little innuendo here.
And I was like, but it's, I mean, that's what the gods were like, and I love that they're not shying away from that.
Right. And Rick never really shied away from it either. Like, this, they are completely inappropriate half the time.
Yeah.
But it's like, because it's a middle grade book, he makes it a joke, he makes it funny, and I love that they're not shying away from it. It's very much here.
Yeah.
So Hermes shows Percy, announces to Percy, that the Princess Andromeda, this giant cruise ship, is his ticket out of here.
Mm-hmm. Which Percy is not aware that that's Luke's ship.
No.
Right. Okay.
Nor are we, technically.
Right.
Like, all he says is, there's your ride.
Yeah.
And he also brings a couple of gifts that he says are from Poseidon, whether it's from Poseidon or whether Hermes said, hey, you're gonna need these, I'm bringing these to you too.
Yeah.
We don't actually know, because it's Hermes and you can't trust him. But he does bring the Thermos of the Four Winds and the vitamins that make you feel like yourself again.
Yeah. We know when they're gonna need those. I love that, like, they probably could have gotten around, like, needing these items, but I love that they included them from the book. Like, it just makes sense. It already works out perfectly, so...
Well, and it also, again, he's going off on this quest supposedly alone, and it makes some sense that Poseidon says, Hermes, can you take a couple of things to my kid? He's gonna need something. And, like, these are the things that he's like, okay, you may come across a time when you need these. Yeah. He also brings him a boat, by the way, a little inflatable raft to get him out to the cruise ship, which, I mean, he is a son of Poseidon. I feel like he probably could have figured it out, but... But Percy calls out Hermes, and this moment where things get real serious, after the gifts are given, it gets real serious, and Percy talks about, like, all I want from my dad is a response, and here you are trying to save Luke when he wants to tear down Olympus. Like, Percy calls him out for wanting to save Luke, despite Luke being a traitor to the cause, and, like, the tension in this moment between the two of them, and Hermes, like, you could almost see him wanting to, like, let the godly power flow. Like, you can see him wanting to be like, how dare you talk to me like that? I'm a god. But at the same time, he understands Percy's anger and why Percy is reacting the way he is. And he's one of the more personable gods. Like, he's not Ares who's just gonna go, you know, pure godly form the minute he wants to. And I loved that this moment is very contentious, but, like, they both kind of get each other.
And the way that Lin says, he's my son, twice, like that, I mean, his voice breaks just a little bit. First of all, kind of threw me back to Hamilton, like, like, kind of put me back into that space. But, like, there was so much emotion behind that, that once again, I was like, I see why they did this. Like, they made the right call making him Hermes.
Definitely. So then Hermes leaves, and Percy is getting ready to get in the boat and leave. And Annabeth comes running down the trail. Not really running, walking very stealthily because she's Annabeth and she doesn't run. Are you kidding? But she shows up on the scene and Percy and her have a discussion. And you very quickly find out that Percy has reasoned away all the reasons why she's betraying him. Like, he knows Chiron told her something.
Yeah.
And I just give Percy so much credit because he took what Grover told him in that empathy link dream and he reasoned it out. And he's like, she talked to Chiron. Chiron knows everything. He obviously told her, I can't go on this quest, but why? And that's the question he needs to ask her, is why. And this conversation about them being friends and them both acknowledging that they've been keeping secrets this year, that Percy didn't talk about Tyson in his letters because he didn't want to focus on Tyson. He wanted to hear about, you know, everything going on with Annabeth, and Annabeth not wanting to talk about all the human things that completely let her down. Mm-hmm. Going to movies and going to Disneyland and being a normal kid in school, it's all boring and stupid, and she just wants to be a demigod and do demigod things. I love the juxtaposition of Percy being so good at being a kid and kind of just now learning how to be a demigod, and Annabeth is the complete opposite, and them just, like, saying, like, we're still friends. Like, just because we're having a tough time, like, relating at the moment doesn't mean we're not friends. And, like, yeah, it's just such a good scene.
Yeah.
I also loved Percy's line here when he talks about talking about things makes them less scary. I think that is very true, but it doesn't make it easier to talk about them either. Like, knowing that sharing something scary with somebody will make you feel better doesn't make it easier to talk about. Yeah. And that, I think, is the only thing he left off this. It's like, because she responds with, if I tell you about this scary thing, it's just going to get scarier because that's going to make everything more complicated and worse.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so it's just one of those situations where she can't tell him more than he already knows, and he wants to know everything, and until they figure out, you know, until something happens, it's just going to be contentious.
Yeah.
So at that moment, as they're standing on the beach, Tantalus walks up and basically announces, well, you broke the law, so now it's time to die. Look at my crossbow. And my question is, technically, Percy hasn't left camp, and he specifically talked about there being anyone outside of camp, outside the border of camp, he said this in their little meeting, anyone found outside the border of camp would be considered, they have broken the law and would be, like, executed. Like,
so is the beach not outside of camp?
Well, that was my question. Okay. It's like, I would imagine the beach is probably, like, camp property. Why wouldn't it be?
I know that they have, like, the lake.
Yeah.
And that's part of camp, but the actual ocean part with the beach, I'm thinking maybe that is outside camp. I mean, they're not specific about it, but yeah. I would assume since he broke the law.
Yeah, I just assumed since it's kind of like I don't know if this area of camp is technically, like, a peninsula or, like, what. Like, I just assumed that was, like, the natural border is the beach. So I was like, did he actually, like, break the law? But maybe he did. Maybe he is beyond the border. But yes, Tantalus is ready to... He is ready to take him out. He's got his crossbow loaded. The arrows are tipped with celestial bronze, which is excellent for killing demigods, and he is all ready to take him out. And Tyson comes flying through the forest, knocks the crossbow out of his hands, and gives him just enough time to get in the boat and get out of the dodge. Tantalus's yell when he misses with the second arrow is so, like... visceral. It's convincing. Yeah. I believed how angry he was.
Him, that, like, kicking the rocks and stuff and stomping
just
around,
like, throwing
flailing a tantrum.
And,
So it was great. And also, he didn't technically miss. Percy got it with his sword and saved Annabeth because she was trying to help patch the hole in the boat, and that was, I mean, good reflexes, Percy. That's
absolutely
pretty awesome.
And thank you, Riptide.
Yeah.
Yes. So I guess it's time to go on an adventure. The line from Annabeth here, as they're on the boat headed toward the Princess Andromeda, and she says, "Tantalus was right. We broke the law. We can't ever return." I was trying to remember. Is that, like, book law? Or is that show law?
Yeah, I don't know, because I don't necessarily remember that. I know that, like, they'll get in big trouble.
Right.
But them, I think it raises the stakes a lot.
It does.
Like, people who don't know what's going to happen are going to worry that they can't go back to camp.
That was why I wondered if maybe they made it law, as opposed to just, like, camp rules that they broke. Is if it's, like, God law, if it's the law of camp that they've agreed to not break... then it makes it, this raises the stakes just a little bit for how desperate they will be to save camp and to save Grover and make it back. So yeah, that brings us to the end of the episode. I did also want to point out that they dedicate this episode to Danny Virtue, who we will talk a little bit more about in the podcast, but here's some basic information about who Danny Virtue is, in case you didn't look it up yourself. It was a very talented member of the stunt team for this season. He has been working in British Columbia for a long time on so many projects. Projects he has worked on include movies like War for the Planet of the Apes, The Twilight Saga Eclipse, Jurassic World Dominion. He also worked on Smallville in The Last of Us, in addition to so many other things. There's a million projects that film in Canada, and anything that involves horses at all, Danny Virtue was probably involved, because he is just that skilled. They say that he was absolutely vital in getting the chariot scene to work. And again, we'll talk a little bit more about that when we get to the podcast here in a second. But he passed away during filming after the chariot scene was done. And I thought it was really sweet and very touching that they dedicated this episode specifically to him.
Yeah, 100%.
So we get the preview for next time, and just briefly, Clarice gets her quest. We actually hear a little bit of the wording, and it's, you know, "You shall sail the iron ship with warriors of bone." That's the only line we get, but I thought it was worth mentioning.
Uh-huh.
And we see them actually, like, board the Princess Andromeda and all the chaos, and I'm so excited.
It's gonna be a good episode.
Yeah. Okay, so that wraps up our episode. So now we move on to the official podcast recap. I'm going to try and run through this pretty quick. There's a lot of, like, really good behind-the-scenes info. The guests on this episode are Tim Simons, James Bobin, and Dan Schatz, as well as a little brief appearance by Rick via video. So there's, you can imagine, those people, especially James and Dan, have a lot of behind-the-scenes knowledge and information to share with us. So you should definitely watch this one, even if you don't watch all the podcasts. I recommend this one if you like to know kind of the behind-the-scenes stuff. Number one, Arian had 8 fittings for the wedding dress.
Yes.
He calls out the costume team and just says they're incredible, but the dress is just, it's perfect. I love it so much. Tim Simons is guest number one, and he, like, starts it in full costume without the makeup, and they make a whole bunch of jokes about the makeup. I imagine the makeup probably took a while for him, because it was kind of, like, a lot of, like, marks and scars.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
But Tim Simons' kids are really big fans of Percy Jackson, and he did not tell them that he was being cast or that he auditioned for it. So when he told them, like, oh, yeah, I'm going to be a part of Percy Jackson, apparently they freaked out and were very, very excited. And I kind of already talked about Tantalus, like, he's not on as high a footing as Mr. D, but he likes to play like he is. And mm-hmm. I think that dynamic between the two of them will just be fun to see play out the rest of the season. He also kind of hinted at this, and it made me think, the adults on Percy Jackson get to be silly and have fun, mm-hmm. where the kids are the ones holding the burden of keeping the plot moving and keeping things serious and getting us to where we need to go. But all the adults just get to play. And I'm like, you know what? That is a really good point.
It must just be a fun show to be on.
Like, no matter what character you're playing, it's got to be just such a good time as an adult to be on this show. As we add more and more adult characters, as we see more of the gods and all that, I'm really just going to keep that in my head.
Yeah.
Like, they're just all having a great time in the sandbox. Okay, so this brings us to James Bobin and Dan Schatz. They come out next. Arian asks Dan why Tantalus would lock Percy in cabin confinement instead of encouraging him to participate in the chariot race and get himself killed so he doesn't have to deal with him anymore. And I love that Dan is basically like, he doesn't like him, so he doesn't want him there. He doesn't necessarily want him dead. He's just like, if I lock him in his cabin, then I don't have to deal with him.
Yeah, I don't have to see him. And it's just a way for him to, like, throw his power around.
Exactly.
So that made total sense to me.
Right, me too. Arian asked it, though, and I thought that was kind of interesting. Arian also takes a moment to talk to Rick, specifically about Mrs. Dodds. I don't know if I knew this. I knew there was something about Mrs. Dodds being, like, based on a real character. Mm-hmm. But the person that Mrs. Dodds is based on was named Mrs. Dodds.
I don't think I knew that part.
And that he told her about what he did with her character in the book, and she loved it.
Yeah.
She was like, everyone's always afraid of me now. The kids come into my class, and they're terrified, and
makes
I love it.
Makes her life easier.
Right?
That was funny.
I just love that he took the time to go and say, like, I turned you into a monster. I'm sorry. And she's like, don't be sorry. This is cool. Like, I'm down. So funny. Love it so much. We go on to find out that Tantalus's look, his style, was based on Robert Smith from The Cure, and they share a picture.
It's pretty good, yeah. And, like, when I first saw him as Tantalus, I was like, I don't know about this. Like, I don't know about his hair, and, like, it was just kind of wild. But, like, I get what they were going for, because he is from the underworld. He's supposed to look a little shaggy and rough, and, I mean, I think they did a good job.
I mean, when it comes to the adults and style, so far we've had, like, Zeus in a suit, which fits his character to mm-hmm. a T. We've had Mr. D in his cutoff shorts and shirts, which we knew that's what he was going to be wearing. I don't think any of us were at all confused by Chiron and his little elbow patches and, you know, dressing really nice.
Poseidon's was very
on
brand.
And, like, Hermes was in, like, sweats and, like, really comfortable last season.
Yeah, like,
with
joggers.
Right.
And, like, yeah.
So it's like, nobody has really pushed the envelope. They really pushed it with Tantalus because he is directly from the underworld and he's cursed. So it's like, they couldn't really they had to just literally transplant him from the underworld to camp. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to, like, change a whole lot. And I think his look just lends to the character. It just, mm-hmm. it works.
And he stands out amongst everybody else, and that is the point.
Yeah, definitely. During the scene with Mr. D and Tantalus on the little dais at the chariot race, you'll see a giant, like, bowl of fruit on the one thing, and apparently it was, like, attracting wasps the entire day. So while they were filming the Stymphalian birds, like, attacking, he's like, I'm pretty sure you guys were just swatting away real wasps, and it looked really great.
Yeah, and they just kept it in there, which was hilarious.
Right? I was like, that actually cracks me up. And especially funny since Tantalus can't eat, so the grapes were there for Mr. D, and they were, like, on the other side of the dais, so it's, just great. And they also mentioned their first assistant director, Jim, was yelling at the kids, narrating the entire, like, chariot scene bird attack, and apparently was, like, MVP of the day. Like, him yelling all of these directions was, like, the perfect way to get the scene shot, and they called him out and said, we're really grateful for his work.
Yeah, that's awesome. Because imagine, like, a stadium full of kids who have to react in certain ways to invisible things, and, like, when you go through and you look at, like, all that stuff happening, it's very realistic looking. And I love that even Arryn was impressed the fact that they added in little, like, tufts of hair and, like,
you know, clothes,
yeah, and all that stuff that the birds were, like, grabbing, and, yeah, it was perfect.
Industrial Light and Magic, known for their work on Star Wars, did the birds, mm-hmm. and he said that they even added, like, jackets to the kids for the birds to, like, digital jackets for the birds to peck at.
Okay, I don't think I realized that part.
Yeah, because when they shot it, the kids were just running around and batting at stuff and, you know, pretending, but when they put the birds in, they actually created clothing for them to, like, peck at, because obviously they didn't have birds pecking at the children. Yeah. So, it's like, that's really cool, and it looks good on camera, mm-hmm. too, so it's, yeah, very well done. They shot the chariot race for 11 days for 6 minutes of footage, I think is what they said at the end.
But so you know, like, what? Greatest 6 minutes of footage.
Right? It's so good.
Yeah.
It's so good.
And I love that they really wanted to do this practically, that they, you know, really wanted real horses and real chariots. And obviously they had to get some stunt doubles for the kids and stuff, but, like, that's why it looks so good, is because it is real.
Yeah. And they mentioned that at no point were the kids ever in a chariot with the horses. Like, they, in order to keep everyone safe, if the kids are in the chariots, it's like being pulled by a dolly. And if the horses are in it, it's a stunt person. And apparently there was, like, a whole team of, like, younger stunt people that all knew the horses really well and knew how to work mm-hmm. with horses, so they just basically brought a whole team of, like, an equestrian team or something in to play the kids, which is just crazy. It's cool though. The next bit we got was about Danny Virtue, which is a lot of what I already kind of talked about, but he trained the horses for 3 months for the chariot race, and that Dan actually went out to Danny's house and showed him the cut of the chariot race a week before he died.
Thank goodness.
So he got to see it, and I love that. I love that he thought it was important enough to get the cut done and to take it out and show him.
Yeah.
Because I'm assuming he had to have been sick, and they knew that something, you know, he might not make it to the show. So I'm really grateful that he had the forethought to do that for him, and apparently, Danny Virtue just had the biggest smile on his face watching this whole thing unfold on screen. And all of the kids got to go to Danny Virtue's ranch to learn how to ride. Even Arryn, who had no interaction with the horse this season. Mm-hmm. And I love that they include, like, all the main kids, even if, like, they don't have mm-hmm. direct...
It's a bonding experience.
Right?
And also, like, that kind of exposure to certain things like that. Like, if you have another project in the future where you do have to ride a horse, you already have a little bit of experience under your belt. Like, it's just a really good thing to be able to do.
Yeah, because even Charlie, who... We saw him fly on Pegasus, on Blackjack, early in the season. Like, he wasn't in the chariot scene. Mm-hmm. So, like, unless he's got more horse stuff down the line... You know, he didn't necessarily have a massive reason to be there either, but I love that, yeah, they included everybody on that one. So we also kind of learned, like, we've seen Tim Simons, we talked about him being on Veep. Like, he's worked on a lot of, like, small-scale comedies where you're in an office, it's not a big-scale thing, and he talks about how cool it was to see a big-budget thing, like, going on and all, and he got to sit on a couch
with that part.
Jason Mantzoukas and just watch all these people go to work around him, and he just gets to hang out and, like, I thought that was really fun. And what a way to kind of, like, step out of your comfort zone with, like, I do office comedies and I do this, and, like, now you're in this giant, like, action scene and you don't have to do anything, but, like, you're still there for the whole thing. It's gotta be the best way to, like, baby step into action movies. Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier the kind of assistant satyr for Tantalus. We found out his name is Ryan, and that Arryn had to teach him the goat walk.
That was maybe my favorite part from this whole episode, because we actually got to see a part of the video, too, and about how, like, you had to be on your tippy toes, but squat down a little bit, which, leg day, oh my god,
yes.
To be able to have to do that all the time, but... Yeah, I mean, that was because he was taught how to goat walk, and he very seriously calls it goat walk.
Yes.
Like, it's a whole thing.
Yes.
And he got to be the one to teach this other guy how to goat walk, like, pass along the knowledge, and, like, it just...
Like, recorded a video on
I just loved it. It was so sweet and funny, and it was great.
Recorded a video on his balcony showing Andrew how to do it, and, like, yeah, just... It's so cute. It's so,
and
so
I
cute.
Love that they, like, I think the guy who plays the assistant, Sader, is, like, his physicality was very good. You can see him being, like, very tentative and stuff, and it worked out, like, really well.
He's great. Yeah, I hope we continue to see him in that role the rest of the season and, like, see how he kind of uses that to his advantage, for sure. Also, when they were planning camp, and I'm kind of surprised we didn't hear this last year, but when they were, like, designing camp, they literally designed it like the camp was there and the trees grew in around it, was specifically the idea they were going for, which I think is kind of fascinating and also explains why there are really big trees kind of in the way of the shot. Mm-hmm. Like, you're like, you wouldn't necessarily think, like, oh, let's put giant trees in front of each of the cabins, but, like, that's the vibe they're going for, is this is where a tree grew. It wasn't there when we built the building. It just is what it is.
And it works really well. And they talk about how long it took them to find a spot, because so many other spots have been used for filming, and, you know, they had to find something that's sort of untouched, and I really loved that.
Especially in, like, the Vancouver, Canada area. Yeah. There's been so much shot there that you gotta find something fresh and new. Lynn was their first choice for Hermes, and, like, their, like, long shot choice. Like, they were like, there's no way we'll get Lynn, but he'd be great for this. And Lynn's son is, again, a massive Percy fan, and Dan Schatz and Lynn both went to Wesleyan different years, and apparently they have, like, some mutual friends, so they kind of, like, put out feelers for him, like, with people he knew, and said, hey, if you're interested in this, give us a call, we would love to have you. And Rick ended up writing a letter to Lynn, and Lynn was like, absolutely, I am in.
Like, immediate response.
Yeah.
And I love that so much. And they talked about how Rick and Lynn have, like, exchanged messages on Twitter before and stuff. And I think Rick is that kind of person who, obviously, he is quite well known. He is a very accomplished author. But at the same time, he's, like, a children's author. So, like, yes, he's got, like, a pretty high status, but he's not, like, an A-list movie star either. But, like, I think the people who know of him and know of Percy Jackson, especially because it's been around for 20-plus years, like, he garners a lot of respect.
Mm-hmm.
And for Lynn, who is very in demand for, like, literally everything, and it probably doesn't hurt that this is also a show on Disney, because Lynn's worked with Disney a ton.
And he doesn't have to do long shoots. He can do a couple of days here and there and still get all of his stuff in,
But I really love that this came down to Rick writing him a letter and Lynn getting that letter and immediately saying, yes, I'll do it.
Yeah. I love it so much. It's like, yeah. It's just, and again, we were a little like, okay, but the more we get of Lynn as Hermes, it just, he's making it his own, and it's amazing. James Bobin also talks about his mom being on set a lot with him. Like, she's usually in Video Village, like, watching the footage and all that. And when Lynn is on set, she is, like, at attention, and she's coming to set and watching Lynn work and taking pictures. And he was talking about how he's got so many photos on his phone of the two of them just, like, being besties.
Yeah. Also, can we please point out that his mom did not look old enough to be his mom?
She did not.
She looks fantastic. And I loved that, like, the both of them just talked, like, all day long. Like, they became besties. And I love that random, like, especially big celebrities who are like, you're an interesting person, I want to talk to you about stuff, and just, like, you know, don't think anything of it. Like, that, I just love that story about Lynn.
Right? Like, she just loved all of Lynn's work and got a chance to talk to him and took it. Like, I'm going for it. And Lynn was just like, hey, let's have a combo. The last bit from the podcast is kind of like a wrap-up of the end of the episode, with Tantalus villain monologuing and that being a major mistake.
Loved that. I love that specifically, like, he couldn't not do that because he's been planning this for so long. He wanted the gods to watch. He wanted to, like, just live in this moment. And, like, yeah, that was his mistake. But, like, I don't think if he did it again, I think he would still monologue, you know, like, if he had another chance.
This is his chance to be out of the underworld and wreaking havoc, and, you know, he doesn't get that opportunity with his punishment in the underworld. So, like, he's taking full advantage. He's definitely going to be planning his revenge on Percy and for everything that went down here. So that's going to be fun. Also, they talk a little bit about how Tyson is, at this point, Percy's most loyal friend, because both Grover and Annabeth have betrayed Percy in order to protect him, yes, yeah. But they've both been willing to betray him in order to keep him safe. So right now, Tyson is his protector. He is the most loyal, and so I wonder if that will be, since they pointed it out here, I'm curious if that will continue to kind of come into play down the line here. Mm-hmm. And then lastly, the scene on the beach with Percy and Annabeth, apparently that conversation and just the chemistry and the tension on the beach, the whole scene went way deeper than they initially thought it would. And, like, the way it was being acted and the way they were relating to each other just felt way more, like, intimate and... For, like, the friendship connection thing going on in that scene was just more than they ever could have imagined for mm-hmm. it. So, like, they were very pleasantly surprised with how well Walker and Leah really did with that material. And yeah. I just loved that, like, even they're surprised by how fantastic they are.
There's a lot of emotional depth between the two of them so far in two episodes. And I cannot even imagine what else this season's going to bring, let alone season 3 and beyond. I'm so excited.
Well, and, like, the stuff we get into by the end of the season with Annabeth and her fatal flaw and, like, mm-hmm. all the stuff with the sirens. Like, I'm like, oh, man. Oh, man, can I really can't wait to see how everything shakes out from here on out. So that wraps up the podcast coverage as well. I really, really recommend checking out the second one. The first one was cool with all the kids, but the second one just has so much info. There's a lot even I couldn't really fit in to talk about, and just watching them all talk through all this is really fun, and Aryan does a great job. So
yeah.
Definitely recommend. Prophecy Radio is produced by Subjectify Media. You can contact Prophecy Radio directly on Instagram at Prophecy Radio Podcast or email us at prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. You can find us on Spotify, Apple, or any of your favorite podcast platforms. Please consider leaving us a review or a rating. 5-star reviews help others find us, and we really appreciate them. Leave us questions, comments, or ideas for episodes or content you want to hear from us in either of these places. We do have an email from Quiva, and I will throw it to Karen to talk about that.
Yes, so Quiva writes in and says, "Dear Kristen and Karen, first of all, I want to say I am so sorry to hear about Callie. I always loved when we got to hear her." Yes, it was always great having her chime in on the the shows, and it's been sad, but really appreciate you saying that. Thank you. She goes on to say, "I love when you do trailer deep dives because it really helps me to notice small details that I had previously missed, such as how messy Percy's room is or Cronus' sarcophagus. Can't believe there's an official Percy Jackson podcast now, although yours will still be my favorite. In regards to season 2, I am so excited. For episode 1, I am sad to see the original sequence of events go. I was really excited to see Percy realize Tyson was the Cyclops, the dodgeball scene, and Percy noticing something outside his window. I understand why they shortened for the show, but still sad to see it go." I feel like we pretty much felt the same way. In episode 2, when Clarice is about to pick Percy, but Annabeth whispers to her, "My heart goes out to both Percy and Annabeth. I feel so bad for Percy because he must feel extremely betrayed and confused." It is interesting that they leave for the quest differently. I liked how in the book, Percy and Annabeth decided they needed to leave together. Didn't they ride the hippocampi to the Princess Andromeda originally? That was cool. Did they?
They rode Rainbow.
Oh.
Because doesn't Tyson call Rainbow?
Oh.
I'm pretty sure.
Okay.
And I'm assuming we're going to see Rainbow because there's a hippocampus in all the stuff.
Yeah.
In the closing credits stuff. So I'm assuming we'll see Rainbow, but yeah, they did kind of change it. And it is a rainbow boat. Did you notice? Like,
no,
the
I
boat
didn't.
Is like pink and yellow and like, oh. I don't know if it's rainbow, but it's like very bright.
Yeah.
So I wonder if they kind of did that as like a...
slight nod.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. I wonder if, like, maybe because Rainbow comes back later in the season that they didn't, you know, CGI budget-wise.
Right.
Could only fit him in one scene versus, like, another one, but...
But yeah, I think Rainbow does pick them up to get to Princess Andromeda,
okay.
If I'm remembering.
Interesting.
Correctly. Yeah.
I love the chariot scene, especially the details on their armor that portray their different godly parents. Also, Percy in the wedding dress, it looks so funny. Anyway, I can't wait to see the rest of the seasons play out, specifically because of the big battle scene at the end that wasn't in the book and that Thalia comes in earlier. Lots of love from Quiva. Quiva, I feel like we have the exact same opinions, and I love that for all of us.
Because... everything she laid out, yeah. I'm like, we either talked about it or, yeah.
And the funny thing is, this email came in, like, neither of the episodes are out right now, so, like, she doesn't even know that we said all of these things and completely agree with her, so.
Good work.
Maybe that's why our podcast is her favorite, because right? We just share all of our same opinions.
We have all the same thoughts. Yeah.
I love it.
But thank you so much for writing in. We really appreciate it. Both your thoughts on Callie and your input on the episode. Please write in and let us know what you're thinking of the first two episodes. I mean, so far we are absolutely, like, gobsmacked. Like, it, you know, they're knocking it out of the park for me. So I'm curious if any of you have criticisms, if you have other things you love about it, if, you know, it's not just all the angst, like me. If there are other aspects of the show that you're really enjoying, please let us know.
Mm-hmm.
So next time we will be talking about episode 3. We're gonna try and get that out a little closer to release date. We're gonna try and get these out either the day after or the 2 days after they air. So keep on the lookout for those. You'll probably see a few more episodes. Kind of really, you know, they'll be a little quicker than previous.
Yes.
Because we're trying to keep up with the show. So lucky you. We'll be doing our best and. Yeah, please let us know. Yeah, if you have anything, any input, we would love to hear from you. Until next time, this is Kristen.
And I'm Karen.
And we're Prophecy Radio signing off. Over and out.